Support for the New Hampshire News Recap comes from you, our listeners, and from New Hampshire Community Loan Fund, helping neighbors invest in neighbors to realize their dreams of affordable homeownership and small business growth. More details at communityloanfund.org/radio.
This is Morning Edition from NHPR. I'm Rick Ganley, and this is the New Hampshire News Recap. Casella Waste Systems withdrew a wetlands permit this week for a proposed landfill in Dalton near Forest Lake. Now, this project's been controversial for several years. In fact, Governor Kelly Ayotte ran on opposing a landfill in the area in 2024. Molly Raines covers energy and the environment for the New Hampshire Bulletin and is reporting on this story. She joins us now over Zoom. Hi, Molly.
Hi, Rick.
So what does the permit withdrawal mean for the landfill project?
Well, the permit application that Casella withdrew was one of a handful that they would need to move forward with the project. So now that they've withdrawn it, they very likely can't move ahead with the landfill, unless they were to apply again and get approved, and that wouldn't be cheap. DES told me this most recent permit that they've withdrawn cost Casella about $200,000. So pulling the application wasn't trivial, and that's why some who've been watching the project are taking it as a sign that Casella is backing down.
Now, Casella has withdrawn a wetlands application before, I think back in 2021, and then resubmitted it. So what do we know about what the company's planning on doing next?
Yeah, I think that's really important history to keep in mind here, because just because Casella has withdrawn the permit application doesn't mean it will stay withdrawn. So when I reached out to Casella to ask about their plans, the company said they were planning to keep pushing ahead in the process. For now, they said that means focusing their efforts on a court case over the denial of another permit application for their solid waste permit, which they've sued the state over. But Casella's narrative is very much that they withdrew this particular permit in order to focus on one thing at a time, not because they're done with Dalton.
And how are people in Dalton reacting to this news?
I got a range of responses, but I think it's fair to say that people are cautiously excited, at least among the folks who have been worried about a landfill going in there for years. I get the sense that they feel this kind of momentum building, politically especially, but they're also guarded because, as we just talked about, this has all happened before, and a lot of them watched it unfold at the time as well.
And there's been legislation in recent years calling for more stringent landfill siting regulations. So, Molly, how did things shake out this session, and how does the proposed Dalton landfill fit into that?
There were a lot of bills to follow this year that explored tightening regulations on landfills in one way or another. Some of them talked about limiting the amount of trash that landfills could accept from out of state. Some of them would have changed the rules about where they can be constructed. And ultimately, a lot of the bills were defeated, and what we ended up with was one bill, House Bill 707, that rolled some of those ideas into a big piece of landfill legislation. And the biggest thing that bill does is create a committee of people with a range of backgrounds who will become the landfill gatekeepers, so to speak, and they'll be charged with considering proposals for new landfills through the lens of a range of factors, and those are things like health, the environment, economics, and more. And I think what's interesting is that some of those factors aren't a part of our current landfill review process, and that's something that really came to light during the back and forth over Dalton. So the bill passed both chambers, and Governor Ayotte has said she's intending to sign it into law.
I want to turn to a problem that's been facing dozens of lakes across New Hampshire that you've been reporting on, infestations of invasive aquatic plants. These plants can threaten native wildlife, they can harm water quality, and, you know, they make lake recreation really difficult. You don't necessarily want to swim in it. So, Molly, what is this infestation that's been happening in several lakes across the state?
Unfortunately, it's really human-driven. Humans help these plants, which a lot of people are probably familiar with by sight because they're so common, like milfoil, which is this feathery plant. We help them move from one lake to the next on things like boats and fishing equipment, and they take over because they're just so good at growing in the conditions we have here. They're not from around here, and they really thrive, and they pretty quickly quashed competition with our local plants. There's also other changes in our lakes that are linked to climate change that can make it even harder for native ecosystems to thrive, and that contributes to throwing things even more out of whack.
So what are people doing to try to, you know, eradicate this invasive plant in our lakes? I know there's been some success. Sunapee comes to mind. But, you know, what are people doing about it?
Yeah, they're doing a lot. They're working really hard because these things grow so fast. So I've talked to people who pay scuba divers to go into the lake and physically uproot the plants. Some people go out on boats at the crack of dawn every week to conduct lake surveillance to try and figure out where the plants are growing. Some people use these giant aquatic vacuum type machines to literally suck the plants out of the lake. And then when things are particularly bad, you can use herbicide. But all of this obviously is a huge undertaking, and it can also be really expensive. So the best thing that we're told to do is to try to prevent infestations in the first place. And that means cleaning, draining, drying, inspecting your boat and anything else that you're moving between water bodies.
Have there been any success stories in eradicating this?
Yeah, you mentioned Sunapee, and I think that's a really exciting story because Sunapee has had an infestation twice. They had a milfoil infestation, and then they had a plant called curly-leaved pondweed. And then both times they mobilized dozens of volunteers and paid divers, and they had success pulling all the plants out, which is huge and a good reminder that it's possible to win.
But of course, you always have to be diligent, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Yeah.
As we're heading into the summer season, New Hampshire Fish and Game has paused a plan to increase fishing and hunting license fees after opposition from Governor Ayotte. Why is Fish and Game trying to raise license fees?
Well, Fish and Game is one of our self-funded departments, which means they raise their own money to cover their budget for the most part. And license fees are a significant part of that. They cover about a quarter. So now that the budget's tight, Fish and Game is considering raising license fees to help fix that. And that's something they haven't really done in years, at least a decade, to the extent that they're discussing now. I want to mention that most of the increases they were proposing were in the neighborhood of a couple dollars, although a couple were larger than that, depending on the kind of license.
So why did the governor push back on the plan?
Well, her office said that Governor Ayotte did not approve because she's against the idea of raising fees. And a spokesperson for her office also told me that Fish and Game hadn't engaged with enough stakeholders before they put this change forward. So Ayotte directed them to put it aside. But Fish and Game was in the process of holding public discussion sessions and hearings when they hit pause.
So where does this leave Fish and Game's budget for next year? What comes next?
We'll see. The department said they'll come back to the fee increase idea in 2027, maybe with some tweaks. In the last biennium, they did get support from the general fund to help them. And at the time, they said that that showed them they'd need to find new sources of revenue going forward to keep doing their work. But I think with this news, it seems like discussions on what that might look like, whether it's going to be a fee increase or maybe some other route, are getting pushed off for now.
New Hampshire Bulletin's Molly Raines. Molly, thanks so much for sharing your reporting.
Thank you, Rick.
You can find her reporting, by the way, at NewHampshireBulletin.com. Well, the World Cup is well underway.
Dale Cotto has scored in the World Cup for the very first time! History for Johan Wesson!
And our soccer aficionado and local World Cup correspondent, Lau Guzman, is here to talk about how folks in New Hampshire have been taking in the tournament. Good morning, Lau.
Hi, good morning, Rick.
I know. I can see you are decked out. You've got your team shirt on.
Always.
You're ready to go. You've been talking with fans over the past few days. How are local supporters taking in the tournament?
Yeah, so I think there's like a lot of hype, a lot of excitement around the World Cup. I did go to a watch party on Wednesday as the Democratic Republic of the Congo did tie Portugal, which is a European powerhouse. It was captained by the legendary Cristiano Ronaldo. It was a whole thing. I met this fan. His name is Nibola Gfred. He showed up with his jersey. He was so excited to cheer on his team. I was stressed, but he looked like he was going to have a heart attack. And Congo made their first goal ever in the World Cup, and he was screaming and shouting.
I feel happy. I feel amazing. Amazing.
I've also met a couple of the Scotland fans. They're, you know, kind of camping out here in Concord while they're like looking for these two.
Yeah, they've taken over New England. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a fan of the Tartan Army.
I know Scotland plays Morocco tonight in Foxborough. Scotland leads the group following their win against Haiti last week. Are you seeing local businesses or pop-ups forming to watch the games or, you know, get involved following the matches so far?
Yeah. So the Manchester City Parks and Recreation are hosting, you know, matches, not the Scotland games, but a couple of them next week. We're also seeing businesses, you know, Super Secret Ice Cream is doing a US-Australia match. You know, lots of bars, lots of sports places are hosting fans, and it's a good time.
And Lau, you're a Columbia fan. As I said, you've got your jersey on here in the studio. How are you doing after Wednesday's win?
I'm buzzing. The match was nearly over. I was just waiting for the ref to blow the whistle and the whole thing. We were in added time. We were like 8 minutes in, we're out of nowhere. We have this striker, Juan Camilo Hernández. He's a wingman for Real Betis in Spain. He just starts this spectacular breakaway, and he's like right on the out-of-bound lines. And the thing is, Hernández is not that big of a guy, and he has this massive Uzbekistani defender keeping the pressure constant, towering over him. And so Hernández kind of trips on the ball, and he falls, and then he gets back up again, and he spins, and he centers the ball and kind of confuses the defender, gets around him, and he kicks it towards the center where leading midfielder is just waiting to tip it in with a beautiful header. And I lose it. Everybody lose it. My family group chat's going off. I think I'm still hoarse from that. It was a great moment.
Yes. Doesn't matter how tired you are. You're feeling good right now.
Yeah.
What's been your favorite moment so far?
Probably that. I also love just like watching like an underdog or like a twist. We did see that DR Congo had their first goal ever in the World Cup. That previously they weren't as DR Congo, and it was great to talk to the fans and watch them celebrate this historic moment.
Any recommendations for us, you know, over here in the U.S., the soccer novices we might be watching our first World Cup, watching that the beautiful game, as it's called?
Yeah, I'd say find something that calls to you. I mean, I've been playing soccer for as long as I can remember. So if the technical aspect isn't for you like it is for me, maybe you're into jersey design or the halftime show, or maybe you like meeting people in your community at a local bar. On the back of most of our Colombia jerseys, it says un país en una cancha, a whole country on the pitch. And this really is more than just a game. There's like so much that spins around this sport. You know, it's about money and politics and culture, and there's drama, scandals, corruption. And at the end of the day, it's just like all about these 11 guys who are given this enormous responsibility of representing their whole country on this global scale. And it's just beautiful to watch.
I don't think anyone could say it better than you just did. Fantastic. And HPR's Lau Guzman, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
When she's not watching the World Cup, you can find Lau reporting, and you can find her coverage, by the way, not only the World Cup, but of all things here in New Hampshire at nhpr.org. I'm Rick Ganley, and this is NHPR.